Hi, good morning and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh here in Hiroshima. We are live and I am with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Tova Kinooka in Yokohama, Japan.
And it is the end of November. We're starting to feel the chill. How you feeling in Yokohama? Are you seeing the beautiful autumn colors?
It's really quite beautiful, actually. So it was, I think, 6 degrees when I went to the station with my son this morning. The leaves are out. You know, we're all sort of turning, changing color in the park around. Much later than usual, but it is very beautiful.
Very beautiful. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I've been doing tours on Miyajima, and suddenly we're seeing all the Japanese maple turning the orange and the red. And oh, it's just such a beautiful time of year. My favorite temple, Daishoin Temple, is doing a light up event right now because of the autumn leaves. So you can go and visit the temple at night and see it all lit up. Yep. It's really, really magical. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Now you might notice from my t-shirt, this is my house. I have an old traditional house. These were kids many years ago. But I went to the Minka Khan event this month, which is a gathering of all people who love traditional Japanese houses, rural life. And it was just a fantastic event. It started with a forest walk. So I made sure I could get there to go on this forest walk together. The local forest expert who took us on the walk was explaining how a lot of the trees, why they were planted so close together. It was an initiative from the government. They got a little bit of money, so they just covered hillsides. And this happened all over Japan with the same kind of tree is a problem. So he was showing how a lot of the trees have some damage from the insects. So the carpenters don't want it because they want the beautiful wood instead. And so he was also showing us how they're thinning the forest, adding more diverse trees. He introduced us to a young woman who was working with them, who's a lacquer artist. She's studying how to make lacquer. And so in honor of her, they're also adding lacquer trees in the new area so that the next generation in the future can have better access to lacquer trees. It's just so exciting. And then with that idea that what do you do with wood that's perfectly good, perfectly strong, but it's not as beautiful? Well, they took us next to a place where they showed us how they do yakisugi, burning the cedar. Yeah. And so they have these three planks of wood together. They just put sawdust in the bottom so no chemicals are added. And then they just light it on fire. The guy at the top was like a chimney of smoke coming out, really hot flames. Yeah. And they do it just for a couple minutes and then they get water on it. And then you have this beautiful yakisugi burned wood, which of course is more fire resistant.
Yep.
But also they say it has a bit of insulation because it expands the wood a little bit.
Interesting.
Of course, it looks beautiful as well, right? Mm. And you don't see any of the damage from insects or anything else. You're covering that. Mm-hmm. They only do yakisugi on one side. That was interesting for me to learn. I thought it was both sides.
Right.
Anyway, I learned so much. And then I've always loved yakisugi. It's so beautiful. And then they took us to one of the renovated houses where the whole outside, of course, is covered in the yakisugi and the inside has been renovated so beautifully. So it was just such a beautiful, all parts of the same problem. How are these people working together?
Yeah.
What you can do, like so inspiring. It was really wonderful.
That's fantastic. It's such a great example, I think, of when you sort of start opening your eyes and sort of zooming out to do what we call the sort of the ecosystem thinking that we talk about in our client work, but sort of not looking at just one problem. So sort of, okay, damaged wood, you know, can't be used. What are we going to do with that? Because our usual market won't take it. To actually zoom out and go, well, what could we do with that? What are the alternatives? And that's helping out somebody else and solving another problem there. It's a really nice example of that, I think.
And you might have seen it when you went to Kamikatsu, but the Onsen Hotel there, when I visited, they were talking about funding the thinning of the local forests.
Yes.
And they're using that wood, using it for keeping their onsens hot, which they need, and heating the hotel. So using it as a biofuel, and some people might think that's wasteful, but by buying it that way, they're helping to thin the forest, which is so necessary.
Yep.
So it that was really exciting to hear about when I went there as well.
Exactly. Because in the economic terms, right, that's funding. Then if they're able to sell it, it's funding the work in the forest, the management there.
Absolutely.
So it makes it sustainable for everyone then.
Yeah. So other parts of the Minka Khan that I was a part of, so just seeing everybody walk, talking together, they had great food trucks. I hear Milo was one of the main speakers. He's an amazing architect who does some really wonderful renovation work of old houses, making beautiful guest houses. He was one of the speakers. Mm-hmm. And just a lot of people who attended as well, and their stories about love of rural Japan, buying old houses, renovating. I was part of a YouTube panel. So here we have Maigo Mika, who is based in Kochi. She has a fantastic YouTube channel. Some of her videos have had millions of views.
Oh, wow.
And so she was giving insights, not only about running the YouTube, but like telling stories and how she's renovated her old house as well.
Yeah.
And then I was moderating the Women of Minka panel. Three amazing women. On the left, she has been very passionate about natural organic indigo farming, as well as using the dyes in a small thatch roof village in rural Kyoto. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle, she is talking about her filmmaking obsession with the 72 micro seasons in Japan. And then on the right, she was talking about living in a rural area, developing community through making an eatery out of an old house with her Japanese husband. And, you know, just so many fascinating, wonderful stories and so inspiring, but also it's just so much of their advice is practical.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of, you know, oh, wouldn't it be nice kind of idea, but these are people who've actually done it and they know the ins and outs of it. They tell you the hard truth, but also the benefits and the, you know, how it's really economical. It's really a low cost of living if you're thinking of alternatives, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's great to have these case studies, right? So like you say, inspiring, but also just the practical of, you know, what were their learnings coming out of this and what could we then perhaps do ourselves and how can we apply those learnings? So yeah, really useful to have examples like that. Otherwise, where'd you start?
Exactly. You were in Munich for the Wanyan World. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, great. So the Munich summit, so every year One Young World, which is a gathering of around, well, just over 2,000 young leaders, young change makers, from over 190 countries. They come together, different city each year. This year was Munich. And it's always interesting to see there are big sort of plenary themes every year. So this year's big themes were things like circular economy. We also had anti-hate, which was the first time we'd seen that on a sort of on the plenary list. Gosh, what else was there? Peace and reconciliation. So it was a really wide-ranging sort of sustainability conference. But sort of the key learnings coming out of that, one of them just related to what you were just talking about there, the stories, actually. And one of the things that we are always talking about and sort of helping our clients with is how do you engage people in this conversation around sustainability, right? How do you get people in your companies to understand why this is important? And you can see this was a really interesting panel there. Henkel make adhesives. So adhesives for all kinds of items. We've probably all got them in our houses around us. And they were talking about how they are needing to change the adhesives they're using so that things can be undone at the end of life. So for years, it was just you wanted things to stick together for as long as possible so that the product wouldn't sort of come apart. And that was their strength and what they were known for. But now if they're designing for end of life recycling and a circular economy, they need to rethink how they're doing that. And so these adhesives, they're having to change so that they can then be undone at the end and things can be recycled and without causing chemical pollution and da da da. But how do they communicate that science to their employees, of course, but also their sort of other stakeholders in their value chain, their clients, their customers, their partners, their suppliers. They've really had to think very carefully about how they tell this story in a way that people are going to understand, find relevant, find inspiring or motivating enough to actually make them change their behaviors or to want to get involved in sort of building solutions together. And that came through really strongly, I think, in pretty much all of the topic areas covered across the 4 days of the conference, that this storytelling piece and engaging, how you engage with people in this conversation is so important. So that was a great learning, I think, for our delegates that we took, because they're now coming back. We're back in Japan. They actually tomorrow we start to kick off the projects. So they're coming together to look at, you know, what are the areas, the big problems they want to solve or the areas of interest for them that also make sense with their company. And then to find project ideas and start to put those into action. So they really need to be thinking about what is the story that we're telling here? What's the current narrative around this issue? How do we flip that narrative into a positive one, but one that will also engage other people?
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting and so important to think about those circular value chains, right? Yeah. Along the way and how you can design things for reuse. Yeah. We were talking about Kamikatsu earlier. Of course, that's a big thing that they do.
Yeah.
Is bringing businesses from around Japan, bringing the designers to the end stage and like a electric carpet. It has lots of different kinds of materials. Yep. So getting the designers to try to take it apart, realizing how difficult it is.
Yeah.
And then maybe we should design it in a different way. You know, like just you need that interaction. You need that engagement so much, right?
Yeah. No, it's funny. When we went to Kamikatsu a few years ago with a client and we did that sort of Sodaigomi challenge, the big garbage challenge, right? Where they were working in teams and they had to dismantle everyday items that had come to end of life. That was such a big learning. So the hot carpet was one that was an absolute nightmare to strip out all the wiring, but a suitcase was one of the worst. How on earth, you know, there are so many different materials bonded together in a way which there is no way those are going to come apart. They can't therefore be reused. It was a real wake-up call for them, I think, looking at, oh my gosh, okay, so how do we design so that it can be?
Yeah. And then thinking about adhesives, which is something like we often don't think about, but even like masking tape or something could you make a masking tape that is biodegradable, that would be compostable? These are things people are thinking about, even plastic bags that could go back to nature, that are made from plants. We know there are people developing these strategies and they are better, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it takes a huge shift in mindset. And the narrative has got to be there as well. If people don't get the why, they're not going to change their behaviors.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so important. It also looked like you went to a London climate conflict event. That looks fascinating. Can you tell us about that?
So yeah, this was I was in London for some meetings the week before One Young World, and this was an incredibly interesting panel. Andrew Gilmore has a background in humanitarian work, human rights, many decades of advising high level on that. He's currently involved in advising on the Gaza situation to the UN and so on. But he's written this book on climate and conflict. And so it was a discussion between him and a BBC journalist who has covered these kind of issues for many years as well, particularly from the conflict perspective. And they were talking about, or Andrew Gilmore was talking about through his work, how he's seen the connections between the climate crisis, the situation, and how that is fueling conflict. It could be that it's sort of pushing people out if it's flooding or, you know, extreme weather events that are causing people to move, which then means they move to somewhere that perhaps they're going to come into conflict with people with different values or different beliefs and so on. It's also sort of if people are, or if herdsmen, for example, are encroaching on lands where crops are being grown, then that's starting to cause conflict as well. So it was really interesting to look at how these two things are so intensely connected. And there were a lot of there was Q&A after us as well, and quite a few people in the audience were working on sort of climate issues and things, and I don't think many of them had thought that much before about this. So there were a lot of good questions sort of digging further into that and exploring some specific examples. So yeah, it was a really interesting session, two topics which you don't often see put together, but of course it's all interconnected.
It's so important to make those connections. And that reminds me so much of the kinds of things that they're talking about at COP30, which just finished.
Yeah.
I was listening to Outrage and Optimism, the amazing podcasters who are so embedded and have so much experience in that process of the conference of the parties from, you know, Kyoto Agreement to the Paris Agreement, you know, all of these changes. But overall, it seems like a lot of people were disappointed that there was no countdown to phasing out fossil fuels was the big disappointment, right?
Absolutely.
But you came across a really interesting summary. Can you tell us about that?
So this was from Exeter University, which is actually where I did my undergrad many, many, many years ago. But they have a particularly strong sort of focus there on climate science and have sort of built that into advisory services and so on. And they asked several people within that sort of department to comment on it. And it was interesting because there were quite mixed responses, I think. So as you said, a lot of disappointment that really we're running out of time. Why do we not yet have the agreement on this? And the frustration, I think, came across very strongly that we're allowing several of the large sort of petro states to really dictate what, you know, most countries, I think it was around 90 countries, they were saying were pushing for, no, we want the phase out actually and the roadmap to that in the agreement. But that didn't happen because it was derailed by the strength of sort of lobbying by these petro states. So a lot of frustration.
And of course, the big country did not even represent.
Exactly.
This year, right?
Exactly.
It was great to see Gavin Newsom of California there stepping in, but the leadership of America chose not to. And so that always is a big barrier to negotiations, right?
Very
one
much.
Of the biggest emitters.
Exactly.
But
it was interesting hearing, thinking of Outrage and Optimism, Christiana Figueres kind of take on that was that, okay, well, you're not here, so you don't get to dictate what we do here. So it was an opportunity in that sense that perhaps the I don't want to use the word bullying, but really that's a lot of what it is going on that sort of has happened from the US leadership in the past. Whereas, you know, other people said, well, we need them on board because of the scale. And like you say, they're one of the biggest emitters, if not the one. So
isn't it? There seems to be a real push now from consumers who are ready and looking for better options.
Yeah.
And so it's going to hurt these countries that are not joining and making the aims together because consumers are ready to make better choices. And so I think it's going to hurt these countries that are saying, fossil fuels are the way, you know, we know that's not the way.
Yeah.
Consumers are making better choices, you know?
Exactly. And there are better choices out there now. And I think that was sort of in that summary I was reading from Exeter, that was one of the sort of the positive things that came out saying, well, there are now, we know that renewable energy works, it's available, it's affordable. So therefore, this is not a matter of if it's going to take over, it's when. And yes, people from, you know, some areas can drag their feet on that because they've got, you know, conflicting interests. But like you say, that the choices are out there, and I think people are beginning to be more conscious of that. But also the fact that sort of one of the people in the summary made the point that if imagine what we where we would be now if the COP discussions didn't happen at all. So yes, I can understand there's a lot of frustration with really this is just a talk show and are is actually anything happening. But if we weren't having that, you know, who knows what would be the state right now. At least we're kind of making slow progress and these discussions are being had, the science has been heard, the governments are talking together, which is a lot better than if they weren't. Yes, it's not enough and it's not fast enough, but it's still progress in a sense.
And there's always positive takeaways. I was talking with students about it in international business and showcasing how the Japanese businesses who were at COP, how they're featuring the use of solar technology, things that are not really being done. And that's really exciting. So even if the big agreement seems disappointing, there's so much happening, which is positive and proactive and is making good changes for the future.
Exactly. And I think the key word you mentioned is there was opportunity, right? That I think businesses, whatever is happening at a governmental level, the businesses see this as the opportunity as well. Therefore, you know, they're going to go where the opportunities are and where the future businesses. So hopefully that's going to accelerate sort of progress in the right direction there.
Yeah. And I think the fact that it's done every year gives us an opportunity again to get, you know, enthusiasm going, have those behind the scenes discussions and be ready for next year to really make that fossil fuel phase out happen, right?
Yeah, very much so. Yes.
Awesome. I had at the beginning of the month, I had an amazing experience with one of my favorite, most inspiring people I've ever met, Alex Kerr. Now, you might know him as an author of many wonderful books on Japan. He's been a Japanologist, as he describes himself. He just loves Japan and Japan culture so much. And so it was just such a pleasure to be invited to walk around with him in Kagawa-ken for 3 days and just to have all these deep Japan culture experiences, things that I've never done for over 30 years in Japan. And this is a thing organized by a company called One Story. You can find them, One Story Traveler on Instagram. And they're developing these three-day deep experiences, walk around with Alex Kerr, and he translates. But also, it's not just translating from the shrine priests or the Buddhist monks or the artisans, but he's adding his insights and his knowledge to the discussion and to what he's saying. And so it was just amazing. And I learned so much, and I would highly recommend it to anyone really deeply interested in Japanese culture. So here we are in front of a temple. He's talking about the Neo Guardians, you know, and all the details. And then he has been studying tea ceremony for so many years. So even doing tea ceremony with him was just fascinating because he has all these ways of explaining things that he's learned over many years that you would have to study for many years to get those insights, right? And then, it's just fascinating. We went to a bonsai, you know, so we saw a lot of the artisans at work and then tried a little bit, but then you appreciate how hard it is. Like this is a special kind of lacquer from Kagawa where they paint it with different colored lacquer and then they carve into it at different levels. So you're bringing out different colors and it's just so difficult to do. And you appreciate it so much after you try a little bit and then you see these beautiful artworks. And it's so also really inspiring and so positive to see how they have a school. Where students from around the world, from around Asia and other countries, as well as Japan, are coming and learning these traditional crafts, but not necessarily to make boxes and things that they used to sell, lacquer, but to make art. These are artists who want to learn this craft to do their own art. And I that was the first time I really started thinking about that as a way to preserve these traditional crafts which are being lost in Japan, is we have to give young people the freedom to learn it and then change it.
Yes.
And that still protects the traditions and the culture, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's a really good sort of way of looking at it, isn't it? It's not just that they're going to make the same things, but to take those techniques and the knowledge and the wisdom that comes with that and look at what are different ways to use that now. So it's wonderful to see that evolving.
Amazing. And so speaking of crafts, I just went to a marushe in Takehara. We are developing a sustainable tourism tour in Takehara, the salt sake town. And I was so excited to come across this ironworks maker, and he's making all these beautiful handcrafted things. Is it right? You don't say iron crafts where, oh, blacksmith. Okay, that's what it is. Yeah. And it's just once I picked it up, he was showing me the process of how it's made from a slab of steel or iron and all the ways. And then you pick it up and you're like, oh my gosh, this is made by someone. Like this is really beautifully crafted. And that's what Asby Brown is going to join the show and talk about tomorrow, is how the handcrafted parts of traditional houses and so much culture in Japan, that to us as humans, that really connects to us. And that makes us feel happy and comfortable and excited because it was made by a human. So as we're talking about this switch to AI and robots and everything, we have to remember actually to make ourselves happy. We kind of need people who are making things by hand still. Because that's going to connect to us on a different level, right?
Very much. That's kind of a nice counterbalance, isn't it, to the technology, which is wonderful in many ways. But I like the fact we've got that balance coming in as well.
Yeah. So it was great to see him. I saw him at the MinkaCon, and then he'll be on the show tomorrow. And that was something that he was talking about at the MinkaCon event this year. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people would really benefit from hearing that. So definitely tune in tomorrow. Another thing I found at the Marushe, I know a lot of people are shopping right now. So it's a good time to mention things like this. So I found this guy who's growing his own peppers. And I think he's in Okayama, he's based. And so all these beautiful, like, hot pepper garlic sauces. This is garlic and miso paste.
Sounds so good.
Right? So if you can find these things, I'm sure you can in your area. Look for them at festivals, food, farmers markets, that kind of thing. And try to find reusable packaging, so glass and metal. This can be recycled in Japan, or you can reuse it, right? These are things it's worth thinking about now as we're buying things for the holiday season, right?
Absolutely. No, it's a great way to support the local sort of, well, local economy, I guess, artisans, farmers, and so on. So,
Absolutely. And it's exciting. I think it's more interesting, and usually it's really high quality, and it has a good story with it that you can tell people when you give it to them, you know, and because you're interested in it, they're going to be more interested in it, you know.
Wins all around.
Wins all around. And then I had the chance the other day to talk with Stuart, who is planning the Minka Summit for next year. And that will be at Hanase Village, which is in rural Kyoto, April 24, 25, 26. So mark your calendars. It's always a great event as well. Hanase Village is lovely. So here is one of the workshops. I think they're doing thatch workshops, so showing you how thatch roofs are made. But he has some great speakers coming this year. This is Jeff Berglund, and he will be the keynote speaker this year. But one thing I'm really excited about is if you go on Friday, you can go and see Jeff Berglund's beautiful Riverside Machia in Kyoto. Mm-hmm. And he'll give you a walk through his beautiful old traditional house. Fantastic. And tell you all the stories of all the parts and how it's been renovated, what the history is. And I love that kind of thing. So I am definitely crossing off all my work. I'm going to get there right from the get-go.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So I would highly recommend, if anybody loves Japanese culture, traditional houses, you should really try to get there for the Minka Summit.
Wonderful. Oh, that sounds like an amazing experience.
Tova, was there anything else? I think that's our 30 minutes. You got anything quick?
Yeah, well, just maybe one point related to that was something came up on my social media feed yesterday about something called Homework Village.
Oh, yes.
In the extended Tokyo area, where they're repurposing old schools. So a lot of school buildings, because the population shrinking, particularly the younger population, they are repurposing schools. And this one has done a great job, I think, of creating this community hub. You can see it's got gardens there. People can go and work. It's got the little sort of markets, events. You can rent event space there. It's got even a sort of startup advisory sort of hub there as well. So what a great way to repurpose a building, actually. These, you know, large buildings very often that just stand there empty and sad and unused. But what a great way to kind of revitalize the community and create a space that's really practical, really usable, really valuable for the whole community. So I thought that was a great example to see.
It is, because often we don't have to knock down the buildings. They're already there.
Exactly.
They're stable. They work.
Yeah.
What can we do to just tweak it, rethink it, right? Yeah. I love that idea. And we're all always looking at new co-working spaces all over Japan, especially Tokyo area. A lot of people really seeking these out, right?
Yeah. So I thought, you know, it's great to see that, and it would be good to see more of those kind of things coming up as a great way to kind of revitalize communities as well, not just reusing the space itself, but to give a community a hub, somewhere to get together and do things. So
That could even bring in people to the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Knowing that there is this shared co-working space. So mm-hmm. If you want to start a business in a rural area, you don't have to rent a business space. You can start with the co-working space, right?
Yeah. And if it's all together, then people are more likely to come there and see your business, right?
And collaborate too. You might have businesses collaborating.
Yeah. So many benefits. So I thought that was such a positive example, and looking forward to seeing more of those around.
Fantastic. Well, that is our time. Thank you so much, Tova.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for joining. And as always, if you're watching this on replay, add your questions and comments below, and we promise to respond and send you the links you need.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
Bye.
Thanks, Tova.
Bye.